Welcome to The Scariest Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application that you can take back into the office to help you protect your organization.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
With Tornado Cash offline, what's next? Hurricane Cash? Sharknado Cash? Or we're just going to have to go back to tumbling our Bitcoin in the washer?
Yeah, you a washer full of thumb drives.
Washer full of thumb drives.
That'd be awesome. All right, so our first article is hackers attack UK water supply but extort wrong company.
It sounds like it should be like the plot of a sitcom or something.
Yeah, for some reason, this actually reminded me of an old movie. I can't remember what the name of it is, where these kidnappers kidnap this guy's wife and they contact him for the ransom. He's like, keep her. And the whole thing is that these kidnappers trying to get their money out of this guy who doesn't want his wife back, of course, because she's terrible.
I was picturing more of a Three Stooges style, like, who did you ransom? We ransom so-and-so. Whap, poke, boing, pop.
All right. So what happened was the South Staffordshire Water Company, which was disrupted from a cyber attack. And if you couldn't tell just based on that name, it was in Britain. But the gang that attacked this water plant, which is the Clop ransomware gang, claimed that it was the Thames Water. Thames Water Company that was the victim.
Which is weird because usually Clop's pretty good, right? They're usually fairly competent.
Yeah, maybe it was their intern.
You know, we've been talking a lot about how they're getting more and more businesslike and entrepreneurial. That would not surprise me if they had interns.
Yep. So the Staffordshire Water Company supplies 330 million liters of drinking water to 1.6 million customers every day. And they issued a statement said that they had been disrupted by the cyber attack. But the cyber attack didn't disrupt the actual water supply. So this is more back-end stuff, kind of like the Colonial Pipeline attack, where it didn't directly attack the SCADA systems related to it.
Yeah, just the billing, nothing important.
Well, for the customers, they don't care. It's like, oh, you didn't bill me this month? Oh, man.
Oh, but you know that. The company will figure that out.
Yeah, whenever you mess with any organization's money, then they're going to be the first ones to jump on it.
Yep.
So Clop, I think, you know, the Thames Water Company is like the big one that supplies most of London. So I think they were just expecting a large payday from this because they said in their thing about the Thames company is that they did have access to this gate system and could manipulate the water supply, which affected 15 million customers as opposed to the Staffordshire 1.6. Because the Thames is the largest water supplier in Britain that supplies water for the greater London area.
That makes sense. I don't think anybody lives in Britain other than around London, right?
No, I don't think so. No one wants to anyway. But even though they said they had access to the SCADA systems, they said that they were still responsible and did not encrypt the data. They only stole 5 terabytes. But of course, the Thames Water Company is like, no, you didn't take anything from us. Mm-hmm. So after some back and forth and the denials, the Clop ransomware group released a spreadsheet that had usernames and passwords on it to say, hey, see, we have evidence that we broke in. But the problem is the usernames and passwords on that spreadsheet were for the Staffordshire, and it was quite obvious if you just looked at it that it wasn't the Thames Water Company, it was the Staffordshire one.
That is such a weird mistake to make. I wonder if they were targeting the Thames Water Company and maybe they made a mistake like in their email targeting. Did they just look up water companies in the UK? Like, how do you make that mistake on what company you thought you ransomwared?
Yeah, I have no idea. Where the error was made at doesn't, I don't know. I can't imagine it, but I'm sure there's some reasonable explanation for why they made that error. I just can't think of what it is.
I mean, I guess technically you're right. If you're looking at it from the perspective of IP addresses and just operating systems, it's probably completely opaque to Clop where they are and who they're in. That makes sense. It's probably super easy from their perspective. They just see IP addresses, but
Yeah, actually did not look up where the Staffordshire is located in relation to London. I wonder if it's a suburb or if it's, you know, if it's up by Scotland or something. Who knows?
Well, we have the internet. We're South Staffordshire. It's near Birmingham, which is not that close to London. Not very close. Although the article, one of the articles that we have linked does point out that it's entirely possible that they were both targeted. So yeah, so it's possible. I mean, I'm sure they probably work off of separate groups. You know, someone's doing the initial access and then somebody else is doing the ransomware. They're buying the access off of an initial access broker.
Yeah, maybe the initial access broker mislabeled it to get more money. Maybe they got, what happened really was Klopp was cheated. The access broker said, hey, I got into the Thames Water Company.
Yeah, I got this huge water company.
Yeah, but it wasn't true.
Yep. But criminals wouldn't cheat each other.
Never.
That can't be it.
I mean, honor among thieves, right?
Yeah, they're totally trustworthy.
But they mentioned that apparently there's a job going on. I'm not sure exactly which parts of Britain are affected by this, but at least London, as it seems to be, have some sort of drought. I don't even know how you would say it. Some degree of droughtiness. I don't know.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Droughtiness. They're very droughty right now. Yeah. I can just see. Can you imagine in the US Southwest right now? Like if with all the complaints and all the concern about Lake Mead and the water level in the Colorado River, them getting hit in the current mega drought.
Yeah, I think Death Valley has been experiencing a mega drought for about 10,000 years now.
We're not gonna argue about the intelligence of, you know, building cities in the desert. But yeah, I have to imagine that whatever water providers are providing for like Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and San Diego are probably very high on the list because they would have quite a lot of pressure to pay very quickly.
Yeah, and they're large municipalities too. So the expectations probably that they would have the funds to pay a decent amount, even without insurance.
So why does this matter? Well, sometimes the bad guys are dumb, or sometimes the bad guys are cheated. We don't know. Like I said, Klopp has not always been dumb in the past. But one of the things here that occurred to me is maybe you don't want to move too quickly in terms of action. I'm thinking of the Thames Water Company. Can you imagine like opening up the paper in the morning or getting called by a reporter for comment that's like, well, Klopp has just announced that they've ransomwared you and they're demanding so many million dollars in payment and trying to figure out what's going on there. There's probably a bias to action there. And unfortunately, I did not find the article backing this up. So I will present this with a grain of salt. But I saw an article about 2 weeks ago that stated that the Colonial Pipeline people did not need to pay the ransom, that they had retained control of their systems and they paid too fast. So I have no idea. That was in an article. Like I said, I've been trying to search for that article so that we could stick it in the show notes and provide it as a source. And I'll keep looking before the show goes up in 2 days and maybe I'll find it. But if I don't find it, you know, it's an unconfirmed rumor. But yeah, especially if there's a lot of pressure on you, there may be some pressure to immediately pay and try to get things back online. And then you may find out that you are not actually the ones being targeted, or they're not actually in your system. There's another group that's been doing that recently. The Stormist Ransomware Group, right? They're the ones who supposedly hack places and then claim to release data and try to get ransom data for a data, or else they will release the data, but the data has previously been released by other companies. So they're not actually doing the hacking. This is not fresh data themselves. This is old data, or at least that's what other companies are believing.
So it's data in the public domain. So they're trying to extort people for public domain data.
It's previously hacked data that they're trying to play off that they're the ones who got it.
Interesting. So
they're trying to get paid double for stuff they didn't do.
Well, no, double, just get paid at all.
Well, yeah, they're trying to get paid again for the same.
Well, they didn't steal it though. So they're actually trying to get paid for something they didn't do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what you mentioned a minute ago just got me thinking about the pressure put on companies. I wonder if that would be a reasonable strategy for attackers, ransomware, or extortionists to not even contact the company, but contact the media first.
Yeah. Yeah. Get it started from the CEO down rather than from security up.
Right. You start off with external pressure versus having internal pressure and then external pressure applied. I wonder if that would increase the likelihood of payment.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what should you do about it? Well, like I said, don't move too quickly in terms of action. Certainly in security, oftentimes you have to move quickly, but make sure you're moving quickly with a purpose and that you know, figured out what you're doing and why. The second part, this also made me think of the many instances in the past where I've seen of hackers being idiots. There's a lot of script kiddies out there. And it happens sometimes, and you can't use attackers being idiots as part of your defense in depth strategy, which was which is a term that David coined before we started recording. But when you see attacks like this, where the attack failed, or if the malware failed to run, how did it get there? How did it get to where it is? Too often in the past, I've seen where an attacker, you know, sends malware via phishing attack or malware via drive-by, and the malware fails to run, and then the ticket is just closed. Because people are like, oh, well, the malware didn't run. You know, it looks like the system's not infected. We're just going to close the ticket. Well, if it didn't run, like, how did it get there? What was the root cause? Are there other IOCs? What happens if the attacker fixes the bug that caused the malware to not run and come back? I've seen a lot of attackers in the past that are very single-minded. They come in and they do their one thing, whether that's cryptocurrency mining, or, you know, eBay fraud or mail fraud or stuff like that. And people tend to just kind of get focused on the one thing they do. And then they're like, oh, this guy's only doing this thing. And then they just move on. So just don't let yourself pigeonhole the attacker like that.
Right. You know, we were talking a second ago about the no honor among thieves. I'd say also don't take what they tell you as the gospel, you know, what the attacker tells you that they did or what they've got. You should probably try to verify that what they're saying is accurate. Because imagine if the Thames Water Company had just taken the hackers at their word and started negotiating with them or whatever, even if they later found out that it wasn't accurate, they still would have spent a bunch of time and man hours and everything during the negotiation when nothing happened at all.
Yep. Yep. Invested a lot of blood, sweat, and treasure. So, and frankly, that reminds me kind of some of the other ones where people get DDoSed as cover for data exfiltration and stuff like that. It's very much the look at this hand, not at this one. All right. For our second lovely article today, we actually have a whole series of articles around Tornado Cash, which I know is super, super exciting. There are a whole bunch of articles around this because there's been a whole bunch of talk about it. And we just picked as the lead one, Dutch authorities arrest 29-year-old dev with suspected ties to Tornado Cash, although we'll be talking about Tornado Cash in general. This particular one's from the Register. And as a summary, here's a quote from the Register. Quote, Dutch authorities have arrested a software developer, Alexei Pertsev, suspected of working with Tornado Cash, a cryptocurrency mixing service that only 2 days earlier was sanctioned by the U.S. government for allegedly laundering money for ransomware operators and other cyber criminals. So the U.S. Treasury Department sanctioned Tornado Cash on August 8th. This is the first time, that's interesting, this is the first time they have sanctioned a decentralized application instead of a person or a company. Tornado Cash is a completely autonomous smart contract on Ethereum. No one runs it. It was deployed, and they burned the admin keys in 2019 when it was started. It simply exists. There's no organization. There's no CEO. There's no administrator. It's just there.
What's it mean they burn the admin keys?
So the admin keys for Tornado Cash, that's what you can use to decrypt the transactions. That's part of why it is trusted, is because they got together in a big ceremony with 30 other people and they demonstrably burned the admin keys so that they cannot decrypt any of the transactions.
So what they did was they burned the keys to the ledger, which had the transactions in it, or has the transactions in it?
I don't know enough about crypto. I'm repeating what I heard on another podcast.
Okay.
Sorry.
So because it would seem like then, if I understand the way this would work, is then that there's a public-private key pair. And the transactions are all encrypted with the public key, and the private key has been destroyed. So
yep. You
can never decrypt.
You can no longer decrypt them. Yep, that makes sense.
Interesting. But as far as Tornado Cash goes, the claim is that they launder hundreds of millions of dollars from threat groups like Lazarus, which is the North Korean state-sponsored ransomware crew, which has been responsible for a lot of, let's call it shenanigans over the last few years.
Yes, we can call it shenanigans. Hey, Farba, what's your favorite restaurant? You know, the one with all the...
The bling, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
I think it was bling or sparkle.
Something. I don't remember.
Anyway, the government claims that $7 billion has been laundered through Tornado Cash. But the analyst company Elliptic was only able to identify $1.5 billion. And $455 million of that was supposedly stolen by the Lazarus Group.
Yeah, the $7 billion likely represents all crypto sent through there, as confirmed by another analysis by the Dutch Fiscal Information and Investigation Service Financial Advanced Cyber Team. Fact. This means that only about 20% of what went through there is confirmed malicious, which is funny because we actually had asked about this a couple of weeks ago when we talked about Tornado Cash. I don't remember if this was on the podcast or just when we were having lunch. We were sitting there wondering how many legitimate people use Tornado Cash, and turns out apparently it's quite a few legitimate people use Tornado Cash.
Yeah, it was actually on one of our podcasts we talked about this.
Was it? All right.
Because we speculated on, you know, how much legitimate traffic needs to go through a mixer in order to ensure that there is enough, and let's use entropy for lack of a better term, of the transactions to actually launder the criminal activity. Because you imagine if only criminal cash went in, only criminal cash would come out. So there has to be legitimate cash in there in order to get mixed up.
And I'll admit I was wrong. I thought it was more like 99% malicious and 1% benign. And it appears that it was, I'm sure that the 1.5 billion, that's the confirmed malicious. So it's probably higher than that, but it's probably not too much higher than that.
Yeah. I mean, this is just like the early days, even Bitcoin or any of the cryptocurrencies, where people immediately associated cryptocurrencies with malicious activity.
So that was never the case. Drugs.
Yep, exactly.
But you could buy pizza with it.
Yeah, you can spend, oh man, what was it? The 9 Bitcoin? I'm trying to remember how much money that guy spent on that pizza. I think it was 9 Bitcoin. You know, so at the height of the Bitcoin, that guy spent $350,000 for a pizza. If, you know, 9 is not, wow. No, 9 would be even more.
Because it'd be 60, it'd be 450,000.
No,
60,000.
630,000.
70,000? No.
Yeah, it was 69 and some change. You just rounded a little bit.
Gotcha. That's fair.
Yeah, so $630,000 for a pizza.
Not nothing.
That must have been a damn good pizza. I hope it was anyway.
Yeah, there was another mixer sanctioned 3 months ago called Blender.io. The big difference here, and I heard this in a podcast I listened to. There's another podcast called Unchained I listened to. They had one earlier this week with a couple crypto investors on that were discussing it. And they mentioned that Blender.io was not decentralized. As I mentioned before, Cash is a decentralized protocol. It lives on the smart, smart contract that lives on the blockchain. Blender.io is an actual organization, so it could be sanctioned and much in the same way that other organizations have been sanctioned in the past. And Tornado Cash, the code is open source. It's been pulled from GitHub, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but anyone can copy it and redeploy it as a new smart contract. There's been some discussion over whether or not that new smart contract would automatically be sanctioned. Are they sanctioning the code, or were they sanctioning that specific implementation of the code?
It would depend on the specificity of the sanction.
Yeah, one of the articles said that the sanction was specifically written only against Tornado Cash, and they thought that it could be redeployed and it would not be sanctioned. But another person I heard said that it was, so I don't know. That's why I'm saying there's confusion. I've heard two different people say exactly the opposite on that.
Yeah, I'd have to go to the OFAC and look at the thing, because usually the OFAC is just a list. There's not a lot of specificity around the list, because they have not had to add that level of specificity, because, you know, Bob Johnson is Bob Johnson. You don't have to say, you know, anything more specific about that when you have a specifically named entity like that.
Until we have cloning.
Well, then it would be Bob Johnson A and Bob Johnson B. You know, it's easy to categorize it that way.
Sanctioning your DNA.
They've done it before, the forced sterilization. Because, you know, if they don't have... Like I said, I don't expect them to have the specificity around that Tornado Cash source code. So someone could spin off that that source code, and they would just have to alter it, maybe change variable names or something, or, you know, something that's not going to affect the way that it actually functions, and call it something else, and then just spin that back up.
Yeah. Yep. Kind of like the malware thing. You can change the signature by changing a bit or a byte.
Right. Yeah.
And what's interesting, even more interesting, is the fact since it's open source, I wonder what's going to happen if, you know, 10 more pop up, or they pop up with slightly different names, or they pop up and claim that they're using the open source Tornado Cache code, but, you know, a couple of them redirect all the outgoing stuff into their own wallet, maybe. And they just rely on some of those dumb criminals we just talked about who think that they're washing their ETH and instead they're just feeding someone. Actually, you know what? I may do that. I may just throw that up on the blockchain just to see if I can get some idiot to send me some free
ETH. To give you free money? Well, you also got to imagine that the government's probably thinking about sending their own up as well.
Yeah. I'm surprised they didn't do that, honestly. I mean, I guess they could sanction this and then they could set up a new one. Yeah, I mean, well, they've done that with dark websites, right?
Well, they ran Silk Road 2 for a while.
Yep.
And apparently you could tell when they ran it because it got better.
I'm kind of surprised.
Yeah, well, maybe that was the whole point of sanctioning Tornado Cache. So they can spin up one that they're going to manage, they're going to control, and then everybody's going to migrate to it.
I could see that.
But the US government's been pretty hard on mixers as of late because the mixers don't have... They don't follow what the government calls the know your customer requirements, like other financial institutions. And actually, is a mixer a financial institution that would need, that would technically require a know your customer? I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what the rules are around know your customer. Apparently, the government thinks that you have to have know your customer for a mixer.
Yeah, I don't know.
But the reason the Dutch thought that they could arrest this guy is because they've said that if he wrote code for the sole purpose of committing or aiding a crime, then he's guilty of a crime in doing so.
But we have evidence now that a significant percentage that went through this was not criminal in nature. Doesn't that automatically put lie to their argument?
I would say so. Now, what percentage of it does it? Because you're talking about code that could be used for multiple things. At one point, does the... Is the ratio of criminal activity deem it illegitimate code anymore? I think there's a reasonable argument to say that Cobalt Strike is, you know, malicious or malware at this point because it's so, that article that we went over, that white paper that we went over a few weeks ago said that 50% of ransomware attacks use Cobalt Strike.
Yeah.
That's way higher than any of these mixers used for nefarious activity.
You're not wrong.
So imagine that they could say, well, all right, well, this gun manufacturer, criminals seem to favor them. So, you know, 10% of the guns they produce are being used by criminals. Therefore, that company can no longer remain in business because they're supplying guns to criminals. Same kind of. So the developers accused of being part of the decentralized Ethereum mixing service, which conceals criminal financial flows, facilitating money laundering through mixing of cryptocurrencies. And that's a quote from the Dutch Fiscal Information Investigative Service, who actually performed the arrest of the developer.
Yeah, and this is a decentralized and independent protocol. And this is very much like arresting Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn for writing TCP/IP, or arresting Samuel Colt for inventing the revolver, which we just talked about kind of, but yeah. So, and PGP was kind of the same, although they did try to arrest the creators of BGP for trying to export that because cryptography counted as munitions and therefore fell under the exportable, like it's exporting weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah. Actually, did they print the algorithm on a t-shirt or something like that?
Yep. And they printed it as a book and tried to ship the book across state lines and country lines. And
yeah. So hopefully this all flushes out the same way that came out, where it came out that you cannot do that. That's against free speech. I believe it was a free speech argument, wasn't it?
Yep. It was, I think it was the 1996. Was that the Bernstein versus US?
If you say so.
I don't know. I reference it later. I don't know if that's specifically about cryptocurrency. Yes, it was. A challenging restriction brought by Daniel J. Bernstein, challenging restrictions on the export of cryptography. So that's where source code was determined to be free speech.
Yeah, because I remember when this came out, actually, because I was working in a skiff where we dealt with a lot of crypto at the time. So this was something that we were paying some attention to.
Yeah. Yep. And the developers have had their repositories deleted from GitHub and their accounts suspended, which makes me wonder if the source code is sanctioned too. Why are they shutting down the source code? Which is why I referenced the 1996 court case, Bernstein versus US. Because of that, they determined that source code is free speech and that crypto was not a weapon.
This is a bit ridiculous, though. This is like trying to get something off the internet.
Yeah.
You know, it's too late. You know, not only has the horse left the barn, but, you know, all the horses have left the barn. There's one horse in there, and that's it. This is not stopping anything. And the only thing we can hope, really, is that a gazillion mixers are stood up using the same protocol.
Wouldn't it be funny if the bad guys are all like, did nobody fork this repository? Did Ivan, you were supposed to fork. No, you didn't fork the repository. Igor, were you? No, you didn't fork the repository. Did nobody. They got us. They got us this time.
Dang. And all of our backups are gone.
They're all. Yep. They didn't get it.
Yeah, like so many Secret Service text messages.
Exactly. So not only is the government overreacting, not only is GitHub overreacting, but crypto exchanges have been overreacting as well. Some have started blocking all wallet addresses that have ever used or been associated with Tornado Cash. DYDX blocked any users that had any funds associated with any time, at any time, with Tornado Cash. And they even mentioned in their blog post, they understood that some of the people who were being blocked didn't know that those funds were associated with Tornado Cash because those funds had been used. They had been spent and then transferred and then spent and then transferred. And the person that they were with now did not receive them from Tornado Cash. Because of course, since everything's on a blockchain, you can track where the money goes. Or I guess not money, technically speaking, asset goes.
Well, they call it currency.
They do call it currency? All right.
Well, no, cryptocurrency. That's fair. Nuance.
Yeah. Also, Aave, Uniswap, Balancer all blocked wallets associated with Tornado Cash. And there was a dust attack where somebody sent 0.1 ETH to at least 600 wallets from a Tornado Cash associated wallet, leading to those wallets getting blocked from various exchanges automatically. Aave had a Twitter thread about it where they discussed what happened. And they mentioned that they use an API maintained by a compliant startup called TRM Labs to help them obey sanctions. Which is interesting because I assume that means that also Uniswap, Balancer, and DYDX and others were also using this compliance startup since they all kind of blocked at the same time. But that's interesting. They also outsourced their compliance around this to a third-party company.
Well, I wouldn't say it's unsurprising, really, that you have that a company developed or came up with a business use case that says this is what we are going to do. And everybody who's an exchange is going to need to subscribe to our service because we're the only ones doing this at the time. You're probably going to get other entrants into the market also doing the same thing. But, you know, this is not even remotely unexpected either. If you look at just the way that sanctions work in general, and we just use the Iran sanctions as a simple example, where, you know, the U.S. has heavily sanctioned Iran over their nuclear program. They've supposedly left in exemptions for medicine and things of that nature that should not be sanctioned. And yet those products can still not get into Iran because of the sanctions, because banks are unwilling to finance those kinds of transactions. Shippers are unwilling to do the shipping because there's a possibility that a mistake is made or somehow they run afoul of sanctions attempting to get these authorized goods into the country anyway. So these companies are just following the same suit, saying it's better to be overly cautious than get on the bad side of the Treasury Department and the IRS.
No, so I'm looking at this TRM Labs thing. This is actually really interesting. So they're saying they monitor more than 80 risk categories, and they show things like, is this related to sanctions? Is this related to darknet market? And then based on your settings, they calculate risk scores for each of your entities, and they support 1 million plus digital assets in 23 blockchains. So that's super interesting that they're just watching all the blockchains to see where all the cryptocurrency is going and then like compiling scores. That's super. I would love to see the kind of data that they're building up here. So why does this matter? Well, we're about to lose privacy in the crypto space. Governments decide they're tired of it, so they're getting rid of it.
Well, they never wish it was there to begin with.
Yeah, it just took them many years to finally get tired of that. There's only so many, I guess, crypto or so many ransomware ones before they're like, you know what? We're finishing this. We're ending this.
Well, it's just a matter of the amount of use, right? So the more popular it gets, the more use it gets, the more scrutiny the government puts on it.
Yeah. So
I mean, because it's blockchain and everything's tracked on the blockchain, true privacy was never really there to begin with. People had an unexpected expectation of it.
Well, you could have maintained the privacy as long as you didn't connect it with any centralized exchanges, or as long as you never connected it with anything associated with an ID or an address. Of course, that means you could never buy anything.
Well, I mean, as long as it's not actual currency, though. So until they get rid of the legal tender laws that says you can't use it as money. I mean, if they got rid of that, then you would be able to step over that bar and you would be able to have that anonymity and that privacy. But as long as you have to at some point convert it into fiat in order to get stuff, you know, you're not going to be able to have that. But this sets a really bad precedent, I think, because the Tornado Cash is not clearly malicious in the software or in its actions. And that's true of crypto. You know, we just talked about a minute ago where everybody thought crypto was bad because mostly criminals were using it at the outset. But they're only really able to get away with this because not everyone uses a mixer. You know, some people do. Most people that, you know, based on the numbers that we're seeing here, most people that use the mixer are not malicious folks. There's a 10 to 20% margin where you've got people used it for malicious purposes. But that's the minority, not the majority of the people there. And that's the only reason that they're able to get away with doing this is because not everyone in the crypto space is using these mixers. Only it may be a large percentage of the mixer overall are non-criminal, but the number of people using the mix and service are still a relatively small proportion of the entire market.
Yep. So what should you do about it? Well, if you're still devoted to using crypto, find more privacy-minded coins. I think we just saw Monero got a privacy upgrade, right?
Yep.
If it doesn't have privacy built in, you're about to lose whatever privacy you had if you were ever on a centralized exchange. And if you're not on a centralized exchange and you don't have your identity tied to anything, well, if you ever want to spend it on something that involves, you know, sending it to your house, you're going to lose any of that privacy, or if you ever move it into a centralized exchange. So I would just consider anything that is not have that privacy built in, I would just give up the idea of any privacy there. And frankly, Monero probably is, they'll probably work on that next.
I'm sure. But really what needs to happen is mixing needs to be part of the transactions. You know, whenever you transact in the crypto environment, they need to just mix automatically. So everyone ends up getting mixed. Mm-hmm. And that would be much harder for them to sanction or prevent people from mixing when it's just something that's part of the ecosystem of whatever cryptocurrency you're talking about. I think that someone needs to figure this out and to say that, you know, if you transact in crypto, you will make a trend, you will do a transaction, then it will be mixed and then you'll get your output or, you know.
Can you imagine being a centralized exchange where they had Tornado Cash built in, where like when you transferred crypto out, it would only transfer out like on the hour and it'd be mixed with everybody else's transfers on that hour?
They'd have a hard time right now, I guess.
Yeah.
But like I said, if everyone did it though, if it was just the nature of the way the cryptocurrency worked, it'd be much more difficult to do that because then they'd be sanctioning everybody who deals in crypto. You're talking about, at this point, you're talking about hedge funds, you're talking about, you know, investment banks. And with that, looks like that's all the articles we have for today. So thank you for joining us, and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.